Good morning. Before we start our panel, I'd like to recapitulate what we have seen today and talk a little bit more about modern applications. And I'd like to start by introducing three thoughts. First of all, modern applications are big. What do I mean by that? Well, it's really easy to get caught up in all the apps that are part of the modern applications that we're building on all the different clients. But all of those apps together, the infrastructure that they connect into, and the existing systems that they connect back into are all part of that modern application. They're inherently multi-channel. Increasingly, they are going to operate on both public and private networks, and you really don't have any choice in that. And they're also going to connect into the systems that we have spent the last 20 and 30 years building. The CRM systems, supply chain management systems, the custom apps that we have built. Essentially, we're building a whole new class of interactions, of engagement on top of our existing systems of record. And a modern app is going to have to cross through both of those sorts of technologies and architectures. I'd also like to submit to you that modern applications are contextual. What I mean by that is there's a whole wealth of new data that we're, as application developers, going to have to deal with. We get lots and lots of data and insight from the devices that our employees, that our customers, that our business partners are using. We get information about location, about speed, about frequency of connection, about preferences that users have. We have social information that are coming into these modern applications. We get peer reviews. We get instant feedback, which has to be managed and dealt with. We all have to get much more sophisticated about how we use analytics as part of this process of constant evolution. We have smart products that connect into modern apps, all of which create a historical context that we have to look at, that we have to interpret. Smart apps are intrinsically linked to big data in terms of providing a contextual experience that lets you present a user with an option that meets their need before they even know what they need. The other thing that I would submit to you is that if you want to build and deploy modern apps, you're going to have to have a flexible process and a flexible ALM set of tooling in order to do that. Why? Well, because as we've seen, modern applications cross multiple systems. They start at the platform level, systems of operation, where time to safety is important. You don't want hardware to be fried. You don't want devices to stop working. You don't want to have to ship new silicon. You want to make sure that safety is there, especially if you're talking about real-time products. But you're also integrating with those existing systems of record, where transaction processing, where data integrity, safety, security are primary objectives in the functions and the services that you're delivering. And there, the ALM focus is about time to certainty, making sure that we've gotten it right. In the systems of engagement tier, there's a little bit of a different focus from an ALM perspective. It's about time to feedback. It's about getting customer eyeballs on what you're doing as quickly as possible. It's about creating experiments that demonstrate what the best approach to take is. It's about shipping frequently, multiple times a year, using agile processes to make sure that you get your modern applications out to your employees, your customers, and your business partners. So with that, I'd like to open the floor up to the folks that we've already heard from today and introduce Soma, introduce Jason, introduce Brian and Clemens. Okay, we're going to start with a couple questions that I'm dying to know, and then we're going to open things up to the audience here. You can text questions. There is a text number that you can use from your mobile devices, which hopefully are part of the smart modern application that we've created for the conference today. But the first thing I'd like to do is ask this question, and we'll start with Clemens, about what excites you when it comes to modern applications. What are the opportunities? What are the new business possibilities that you're currently working on today?
The new possibilities we have right now is that we can work together with the business very, very closely. They want to have this feedback very, very fast as a team, and they want business value very, very fast. So that's what the opportunities are right now. We can focus as a dev team on business value.
Brian.
For me, it's really being seen, you know, my development organization being seen as an asset rather than a cost center. So getting that business buy-in, showing that you can deliver fast, showing you can deliver a quality product, and having them see you as a partner, not as just the IT guys or something they seem to just put an endless amount of money into and don't feel like they're getting value. So it's that more of a true partnership and being seen as an asset.
It sounds like you're almost saying that your business partners view software development as more important now than they did a couple years ago.
Absolutely, absolutely. We're seen as a bigger part of the company. I mean, we're a sportswear company. You know, we manufacture sportswear, but there's a lot of behind the scenes systems and things that go into that. And that's starting to be recognized by the business because of the way we're able to deliver now, and tools have a lot to do with that.
Jason?
I'm very excited to hear that because that's exactly what we're doing with the product itself. So we've moved down and used half the number of milestones for this release compared to the last release, using a lot of the same techniques that we put into the tools that I've seen that you're also using, which is great, to the point where our services are now shipping, you know, Team Foundation service every 3 weeks, which is the size of a sprint boundary. So that's really cool to be able to get that and get that iteration out there, get that functionality out there so much more quicker.
You know, to me, the biggest opportunity I see is every company around the world today is a software company. No matter, like, you know, what industry you are in, software plays such a core integral part of what you're doing that I frankly say, like, you know, hey, every company is a software company. And for those of us at Microsoft who are sort of all about enabling the rest of the world to build great applications, great experiences, this is a fantastic, fantastic opportunity for us to enable our customers both to build modern applications and do it in a highly, highly agile way. So that's the opportunity that I'm excited about.
Interesting. Now, I want to go back to you, Brian, because you mentioned that you're working with the business a little bit more often. And when you take that and put that together with faster development, it has me thinking more about startup culture. And, you know, it almost seems to me that, you know, I used to, in this world, talk about the fact that I, you know, have two audiences. I have the inside the firewall crowd, the IT crowd, and the outside the firewall crowd. And they think very differently. They're almost like two separate groups of developers. But it sounds like that sort of distinction is starting to go away as we move toward this more modern multi-channel public-private infrastructure type of application. Is that something that's happening in your organization?
Yeah, I mean, most of our development is really the inside the firewall type right now. But, you know, the way we work with the business and the way that we're able to deliver is much like a startup. It's a very fine line, though. You know, you run the risk. You have to be careful. A long time ago at Columbia, we had a culture where developers and business people were just on the phone with each other. And, you know, we had guys with, you know, the phone on one ear writing code as they're getting requirements. And that got a little too Wild West. So we've had to balance that with a very thoughtful methodology that allows us to get the right requirements, do the right levels of testing, write code in a way that, you know, we can go in and update it rapidly and keep the quality there without slowing down too much. And a lot of these tools we're using now, you know, having being able to use Visual Studio 2012 and TFS 2012 allows us to do both and gives the business a preview of what we're doing real time. And you know, I mentioned on the video about making corrections to the product sooner rather than later. That's really been a big part of what we do at Columbia.
Yeah, that time to feedback thing that I
Absolutely.
Talked about, really, I think you live that right now, right?
Definitely, definitely.
yeah. Clemens, now I know that you work with businesses that are different than Sogetti because you're, you know, essentially doing work for them. How is your relationship changing?
I'm working for different companies, different projects. For example, I'm working together with a SaaS provider, making them available to do some continuous deployment in there. And that connection there is that we start to work very, very close with the testers. So they can test all the applications very, very smooth. And that's the connection we get with the companies there. On the other side, at this moment, I'm supporting the development of 4 Windows Store apps. And we are running 1-week sprints over there. And 1-week sprints, we
want
to have...
That's not a sprint, that's a dash.
yeah, that's very fast, I know. That's, but I've got some very great young professionals running that. And we are constantly asking for that feedback with the customer. And that's when he gets closer and closer to us. And on the other side, we've got one other project I was working on. That was a very highly distributed agile team. We started working with a physical Scrum board in our office, but the developers and the testers, they were in India. The business owner, the customer, was on their own business, on our own company, and we had the designers and architects in our place. So that was a kind of strange, because we had a physical Scrum board, and they were shooting emails constantly at us. And actually, the backlog was our email list. Now, then we started to adopt Team Foundation service, and we really started to adopt it very, very early when the first preview came out. And now the customer really gets involved. He's not shooting emails anymore. He's filling out backlog items, using the storyboarding tools for explaining the requirements a little bit better. And yeah, the connection gets there. So there are different scenarios where we can work together a little bit better.
You know, that's one of the things that I've noticed about the visual requirements when it comes to modern applications, is it's almost like we're seeing the death of the functional requirements document, the 50-page thing that we write in Word and, you know, everybody goes back and forth over it, and a lot more mocking, a lot more prototyping, a lot more wireframing. Is that something that you're seeing in your organization?
Yeah, I read a tweet I said about the videos. It isn't a development video when there's no whiteboard in there.
Yeah.
And indeed, we're using a lot of whiteboarding, but with disconnected teams, that's a kind of challenge. Yeah. And that's why we're using the storyboarding tools, the PowerPoint storyboarding for it. And it helped us. It really helps us to explain better what's going on. And yeah, no more long documents, no more 50 pages of documents, no more huge UML diagrams. And indeed, we start first by mocking up the application. That's what we did with the Windows 8 Store apps. First design the application, what's going to look like, and then start working on it.
Now, Jason, I want to come back to you on that, because I've seen some of the requirements documents that the Visual Studio team used to use. I think I even wrote a couple way back a long time ago. There's no way you could do 3-week sprints with those traditional requirements documents, so you must be changing some of your processes too.
Oh, we absolutely have. There's no way to take a product this large. I mean, you have over 1,000 engineers working on, you know, basically tens of millions of lines of code. You have to figure out ways to go break that up and actually get the teams to work better together. And so we've arrived at a really good solution that allows us to do a combination of top-level milestones, kind of a waterfall sort of thing, but then to give each of the teams the ability to go in and use agile practices like Scrum. And so we're able to go do that. Some of the new features we're adding, Kanban, for example, those sort of things, that came because some of the teams actually wanted it. It was in their backlog, so they just did it. So now we're able to go and ship it. So being able to get that down, move quality way back up to the front. We made a big adjustment in this release versus last. We really put a lot of extra people on fundamentals, performance, those sort of things, pulled quality in. I mean, everything that Brian showed in that life cycle, that's just looking at every single point where I'm doing a handoff or something's required, how can I go off and go make that, you know, smaller, faster, you know, make it really nice and smooth. And, you know, the result is we went from 3 months down to 3 weeks, and now we're going to have more continuous updates, as Soma talked about earlier today. So very excited about that. That's a big amount of change.
And yet, when you're putting software in boxes and you're integrating with, you know, the Windows 8 runtime from a debugging perspective, it seems to me that time to certainty is maybe, or time to safety is maybe a little bit more important there. So,
no, you're absolutely right. So it varies on the parts of the stack. You know, when's the last time you wrote an if statement in your code and it branched the wrong way? That can happen, actually, if I'm playing around with a compiler. But that's the sort of thing where we're going to be exceptionally careful. So parts of the stack, debugging, garbage collection, those sort of things, you know, those actually, they still use the same kind of methodology, but we spread things out and we change that. As I get higher up in the stack and you write down to websites, then I can actually have very, very good iteration. And this is, again, as an example of how you have to coordinate, because at the end, we're going to go do, you know, a preview release, and that's us and that's Windows. And when I hit F5, debugging had better work. That means that's a lot of people that have to line up. So we really tried to design the tools so that it is actually flexible. I can use the customized templates like Brian talked about. I can actually use Scrum practices if that makes sense, but I can also integrate with teams that aren't doing that, and again, at the worldwide kind of scale. So it's it can be difficult.
Okay. So there's a question that I just have to ask, because I feel like, you know, in some ways it's the elephant in the room, and I'm going to start with you, Soma. .NET. .NET versus WinRT versus, you know, HTML5 and hybrid apps and developing apps for multiple devices that, you know, some of which don't have Microsoft operating systems on them. You know, what is the role of .NET in a modern application?
So from our perspective, .NET continues to play a very, very important role as it relates to modern apps, right? We have .NET in Windows, we've got .NET in Windows Azure, we've got .NET in Windows Server, we've got .NET in every platform that we do. At the same time, we do recognize and we do understand that developers want the choice and the flexibility to be able to use the programming stack that they are familiar with, that they think it best suits their application needs. So one of the reasons you hear us talk a lot about, like, you know, hey, whether it is Windows runtime or Windows, or whether it is Windows Azure kind of thing, we say that, like, you know, hey, you want to write an application in VB or C Sharp, we absolutely support that as a first-class citizen. If you're interested in sort of standards-based web, you know, HTML5, JavaScript, we support that. You want to do C++, we support that. On the back end, hey, you want to run an app in Java or PHP or Node.js, we support that. So we are trying to make sure that a platform is broad, open, and sort of supporting multiple programming languages and multiple environments. But at the end of the day, .NET is something that we believe in strongly. I would still say, like, hey, if you look at Windows Server or Windows Azure, .NET is the premier programming environment. At the same time, if for some reason you feel like, hey, some other programming model makes more sense for you, absolutely, write your application, come on over, and we'll run you as a first-class citizen in Windows Azure as we move forward. And if you look at, like, you know, today what we are doing with Visual Studio 2012 and .NET 4.5, we got a ton of new features and functionality coming in .NET 4.5, whether it is ASP.NET and MVC and the work that we are doing there, or whether it is Entity Framework or every other part of the framework that we are advancing to make sure that you can build what I call at-scale services using .NET. We absolutely are committed to doing that, and we are moving forward a big deal today with .NET 4.5.
Well, it seems like if, you know, I want to continue using .NET, and yet, you know, recognize that, you know, the way that you build a modern application is changing, that, you know, in particular, things like the API controller and the async support are things that as a .NET developer I should learn very, very well, because those are going to be part of that idea of an API everywhere that then connects into multiple clients. So I guess that's one of the first things that people should learn. Would you agree with that, Jason?
Yeah, and that's why we did a couple of the features we even showed off today. So for example, the API controller makes it super simple so that I can expose things out and just concentrate on my logic and in the code that I'm going to go write. That's the thing that's really going to open up my API, my business logic, et cetera. You know, that's a great example, and again, works, you know, perfectly well as you saw today, just, you know, new controller. And there I go. Asynchronous is another great example, and that's a case where some innovation that we did with .NET, the async and await keywords and the way we integrate them in the language and inside of the framework, that asynchronous pattern was then something we also borrowed from and used when RT was being created. So again, the async pattern's there and getting a common sort of way to deal with, you know, responsive UI and that modern sort of technique. So again, we are trying, to Soma's point, take some of the best ideas, make sure that they're there, we get a good kind of consistency, but there's a lot of brand new innovation that's happening in their .NET that's, you know, helping drive some of that.
It's a different MVC model, and that's an important difference to understand from a developer perspective.
Yeah, I mean, and it is part of this modern sort of experience. We can't have block UIs. I need to have it be responsive. That means you're going to have a good way to do that. That's both a statement about the runtime. It's also something right around the compilers and the integration, and then the tools have to make it easy.
It's especially hard to build systems for things like Azure or other public cloud infrastructures that are scale out if you don't have, you know, that sort of non-blocking design.
Yeah, no, you have to, and that's another good example, because I need to be careful about how you state on the back end. I got to make sure it can replicate well and keep consistent. You know, that's another good example of, we've got first-class ways of doing that. Service bus is another example of, you know, some technology in .NET framework that's moving forward. Right. Also helps with that.
Now, it seems like it's hard to get around the issue that in a modern application, you are going to have to know multiple frameworks to program against, multiple languages to program in across your development organization. Brian, I know that that's something that you're living at Columbia. I wonder if you could talk about how you're adapting to that reality, because it's no longer Java or .NET. It's Java and .NET and JavaScript and Ruby and maybe Node.js as well.
Absolutely. So, you know, one of the things we look for at Columbia are just, you know, we want good developers. So, you know, in the past, you associate yourself as a .NET developer or a Java developer or an ABAP developer. And, you know, while you do need certain expertise, you know, you need people that are experts in those areas. One of the things we look for are what I would like to call utility players. So, you know, I like people on my development teams that I can move around based on project needs. So, you know, I'm able to flex up or down on the Java team or the .NET team. You know, the managers are able to, you know, have a resource that's not necessarily always assigned to their team. And you've got to be able to do that these days. Otherwise, you build out these development teams that are so huge and become just giant cost centers. You know, it goes back to what I was saying earlier, is being seen as an asset. Well, you know, if you're building these enormous teams and costing the company a lot of money, it's hard to be seen as an asset. So being lean, being flexible, being able to move those resources between Java, between .NET, ABAP, BizTalk, RPG, you know, some of the older languages, it's tough to do that, but modern programmers are pretty adaptable, I'm finding. And again, back to the common tool set, you know, having them be able to work in one tool, see the backlog in one way, regardless of what technology and what team they're working on, is big, because I don't have to waste time having a guy spend a week to figure out how the Java team does things if they're normally on the .NET team, or vice versa. So that flexibility, again, has helped us be more responsive, and has the businesses recognized the value, because we're leaner, faster, better.
And you're using TFS across multiple different languages. Your Java devs use TFS.
Yes. Yeah, right? We use TFS. The Java devs also are using Visual Studio for their source code. We use the Eclipse plugin. So those teams are working in really the same tool all the way across the board.
Right.
And then in some of the other languages, like ABAP, for example, on our ERP development team, basically they're using TFS to manage backlog. So we've put a beautiful SharePoint front end on top of TFS for our business users and our BAs, so that it's a little easier, it's nicer to look at, you know, it's more point and click, so they can get immediate status on things, and they don't have to be programmers to figure out what's going on. So really, it's kind of putting the whole package
all
together.
All right, so I got a push on that. So if the business users get beautiful interfaces, why shouldn't the devs?
So not to say it's not a beautiful interface, but you know, the requirement of a business user is different than a requirement of a developer. The developers don't mind writing a query. The developers don't mind, you know, having to do a little work. The business people, they want it instantly. They don't want to think about, you know, what team's doing the work. They want to know if it's, if it's a go-to-market work stream. They just want to click on go-to-market. The developer, on the other hand, or the development manager, you know, I don't want to look at work from a go-to-market perspective. I want to look at work from a Java perspective or a .NET perspective, or sometimes I do care about the work stream perspective. But, you know, again, it's different, different tastes for different people, if you will. Right. So I can put a nice, with very little effort, I can put a view on it that the business wants to see, versus just the native tool that, you know, developers are very comfortable because that's what they work in every day.
I want to come back to testing, because one of the biggest differences I see in modern application development is when you're trying to release certain parts of the app on a three-week basis, or you're working very closely to get something into an app store, it's very difficult to have a separately organized QA center of excellence that you throw that application over the wall to, and you know, they test it on, you know, they have to be able to test on an emulator or do, you know, manual on device testing and then get it back and keep that sort of timely release cadence. So Clemens, since you're developing apps that you're putting into stores, I wonder how you're dealing with quality in that sort of environment, and how you've organized the team to deal with those tight release schedules.
Actually, two examples. One is the SaaS provider. That was a very huge application. They are running multiple Scrum teams, creating every team creates functionality for one application. And when one team changes a feature, everybody wants to retest it. And with Team Foundation Service and MTM in place, Microsoft Test Manager, they could start querying around it and getting more comfortable with everything, every feature is really very well tested. Because when a development team changes one feature, it can influence a scenario from another team. So that was one thing what we did. So the integrated tools, that wasn't able when we used the not integrated tools there. So that's one scenario where we hooked on the testers a little bit closer to the developers and to the functionality we are delivering. For the app stores, that's a kind of interesting scenario. Because when you are creating an application and putting it in the App Store, it takes a week before it's available for the customer.
Yeah.
Now, when it's in there and it has one bug, it will take another week before you solve the bug, because you have to republish it to the App Store. So you have to be very careful with the quality aspect in there. So we're running 1 week sprints, we have constantly feedback, and we're running those tests constantly and really focusing on the quality aspect of when we're putting it in the App Store, because it's very important that when you have it on the App Store, it runs good.
I think that's actually an important point, because a lot of teams that are used to the web world and they are kind of practicing continuous deployment, and if they find a bug, okay, well, we'll just spin another build because we can do that in a day.
Yeah.
And they get into a modern app that has mobile components to it. They fall into that trap of not realizing that they have been disintermediated between the customer and their system through the app stores. And so that quality piece becomes more important and more like it was back in the early client server days when we were shipping package software.
Yeah, sure. It's you can almost think about it as shipping boxes. When the Visual Studio box is out there and it has a bug, you've got some challenges. You agree?
Yeah. So how are you guys? So how are you guys? You know, kind of doing that quality aspect when you're doing the three-week releases, and yet you have to put something in a box and ship it.
Yes, and that is a huge challenge. So it's something a few things we have done. As I mentioned before, we pulled test much, much further up. So we made development much more responsible for quality, because we used to do a lot of the kind of, well, frankly, toss it down the hall and see how that part works. Like, no, I need this stuff to actually work. So the quality coming up front helps a significant amount when you get that piece done. When we ship every 3 weeks, it's on the service. That helps us because we're able to actually own those machines and the images and that kind of stuff. And we've started to leverage tests in production, so I can actually put new features out but protect them with keys. That allows me to actually have the cycle, the feedback, et cetera, but it's constant. This is a really great kind of example for releasing software. It's just, in this world, I'm more of a fast roll forward. If I find an issue, I'm able to patch it and move the bits forward.
So no rollbacks, only roll forward.
Because if I've got, you know, 10 million, 100 million, take the framework, if I've got hundreds of millions of installations worldwide, and I now have an issue, that's not going to be a fast roll forward. That's going to be the typical kind of patch. So again, we have different techniques for dealing with that. But I think this notion of the quality's up front, I have the ability to move these fixes a lot quicker through the system, that's helping us significantly.
You know, it almost sounds like a modern application is almost more of an organic model as opposed to a technology model, because individual pieces move at different times. You know, you've got this idea, especially when you've got a back-end infrastructure that scale out, of individual parts failing and the rest of the application being able to carry on, and it's just a different engineering model for us to think about. Would you agree with me on that?
Yeah. I'll give you a concrete example as well. We've done a lot of work on this with Team Foundation Server. And so you'll see, for example, forward and backwards compatibility. You may not be able to use the new features without getting everything moved forward, but we know we need to have those endpoints and the version matrix actually land correctly. So again, in the architecture diagram I showed, being able to actually do proper, you know, loosely coupled components, standards, versioning the interfaces and the code in the proper way, that gives you the flexibility, and then teams actually, you know, are more agile. So it's not, you know, the big set of folks all delivering simultaneously in one afternoon on a Tuesday. That just doesn't work.
The one thing I want to highlight as it relates to what you're saying just now is, when you think about, like, you know, hey, moving quality upstream and sort of thinking about quality right from day one, that may or may not mean an organizational statement. Meaning, like, you know, take Visual Studio, for example. We have a development team. We have a test team. So it doesn't mean, like, you know, hey, we say, like, you know, the test team doesn't exist anymore and, like, the development team does everything kind of thing. What we are instead saying is, like, you know, hey, the test team is involved in the development process right from day one, as opposed to, like, you know, hey, I go off, write a bunch of code, and then when I'm done, I throw it over the wall to another team, right? No. When I'm thinking about designing something, I want the test person sitting right next to me thinking about what is it that I'm designing, how do I think about testability in my design, and then go on from then on. So it's more like, you know, hey, the way you operate, and you may or may not decide to make organizational changes to optimize for that.
Well, I have a lot more questions, but I want to make sure that I open this up to everybody that's in the audience as well. So let's go ahead and start to take some of the questions that have been texted in. I think hopefully we'll get the first one up here on the board. Maybe.
Almost.
Okay, got one. Our modern application is actually functioning. Okay, so first question, can a project be too agile? Anybody want to volunteer an answer to that?
I would say it depends.
You know what? You could be an analyst.
yeah. Yeah, some projects aren't very fit for being agile. For example, I worked together with a team which developed software for primary infrastructure of the Netherlands. It's a high risk. It should be very stable software, high requirements. I think when I entered there, the bug workflow has 16 states. So that wasn't completely not agile. We removed several states of that. We ended up with 6 states, and that was the minimal amount of security we could bring in that project. And I would say when we should run that project in 3-week sprints, we can't manage that one. So that project will definitely be too agile when we're going to do that.
Let me give you a concrete example, actually from the release that they were launching today. To me, it's mostly about changing the way you think about how you deliver things. So this is an example. I may have compliance. I may have federal things. I mean, some software that I do, we talk about the long requirements documents. You know what? If it's actually medical equipment or, you know, take your pick, there are necessary requirements, and that makes sense. And we have a lot of folks that do that. To me, some of the things you have to do is change the way you think about what Agile is. It's easy to kind of equate it to, oh, it's just a bunch of guys with Post-it notes that go whip out, you know, brand new stuff every day. Certainly, there's components that can work that way, but not everything does. An example that I had is for a project that, you know, the team went almost too far, is they decided to take refactoring to an extreme, where they just basically, well, I'm just going to start throwing code and see what happens, and I'll refactor. You know, it's like, whoa, we didn't get scalability. Right? This happened in some of our unit testing work. We didn't get scalability, what I was looking for. Like, you know what? In this case, part of Agile might have meant I should use a sprint to actually do some design up front, because in this case, it did require design. It doesn't mean random. And sometimes I hear criticism about agility or Agile practices. I'm equating it that way. It's like, no, go use a sprint to go do your design, then start doing code. Be prepared to throw away things along the way, but it's basically changing your mindset about what it looks like. Once we started doing that in some of the areas, then we got much better results out of it.
Yeah, I want to pick up on that point, because I've spoken with a lot of development teams who have built very highly rated mobile apps. And one of the things that comes out of those discussions is that that design period with personas and journey maps and mocks, which, you know, kind of take a little bit longer than maybe a standard Agile product, where a project where you go immediately into sprints, tends to be something that you know, results in a better user experience. Mm-hmm. So it's an example of where you might vary the frequency of what you deliver, at least at the start of that sort of project. So I think that that's a very common example. And I think a lot of it gets back to you know, when is failing fast important, and getting to feedback. Yeah. If getting to feedback is important, Agile techniques help.
So my perspective on that is, like, there are two things to keep in mind that, at least for me, tells me whether we have the right level of agility or whether we are a little too agile kind of thing. One is, people at the end of the day care about, like, you know, enabling some scenarios, right? So the more when you come out with a new feature, thinking about how the features stitch together so that the user can use that feature in a way that makes sense to enable a particular scenario, we have to think about that in terms of, you know, delivery. The other thing is quality. You know, hey, if I don't have the right level of quality when I do something, that doesn't matter how often I do, people are not going to be excited about it. People will not want that. So you need to think about how you're going to enable end-to-end scenarios in a seamless way, and think about having the right level of quality. And if you can have that balance, then, like, you know, hey, you're in a great shape.
Let's take another question. Interesting question. So where will the future innovation in software development come from? Vendors, businesses, hardware companies, the US, Europe, Asia, where? Where do you guys think the next big things are going to happen?
Customers, I think. I would say customers.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the customer's going to have to... They're going to dictate how we do things.
You know, I actually think it's going to come from you guys in the retail space, because I think wearables are going to be really, really interesting.
Yeah.
In terms of devices that collect information. So.
Absolutely. You know, I think we're seeing some of that now with our business, but the consumer, you know, the direct to consumer areas especially, you know, people are demanding more and more. They want better service. They want more information on the products. You know, from my point of view, kind of from thinking about Columbia Sportswear, we're a technology company, not in the same sense that Microsoft's a technology company, but our technology is in our product as far as our apparel. And getting that information out to the consumer when they're in the store, maybe without them having to read the tag, you know, hitting them as they start to look at a product, that's gonna change the way we develop and the type of applications we develop, because there's gonna be a demand for that. I can't tell you what it is right now, but you know, if you could walk up to a product and something you're carrying, or whether it's your smart device, whether it's you know, some type of glasses, you know, whatever the future holds from a device perspective, we're gonna need to project that right to the consumer based on where they are in the store.
Could you see a time when Columbia would have its own developer program?
Yeah, maybe. Maybe.
Sure. Yeah. Then you'd really be an ISV.
Absolutely.
What about you two? Where do you see innovation coming from besides Microsoft? Let's stipulate that.
Yeah. No, I mean, I do think, you know, the retail space is interesting for a couple of reasons. One is, you know, we showed the Kinect and the recognition sort of stuff. So getting software that can actually compute and understand people and what the people look like, you know, this kind of direct, you know, let me try my clothes on at home virtually. I mean, those are interesting sort of things. The supply chain management that's required and the kind of margins that retail and et cetera are trying to drive, that requires a whole bunch of data coming through. That's now starting to get into the big data and doing crunching. And if I'm going to make good observations, now I start getting to do technology advancements, especially around machine learning, because I'm going to have to start putting together a bunch of disparate things and figuring out how those things go together. So I do think it is a great example of an entire chain, both consumer facing, back end analysis, you know, crunching. These are the spaces where we're getting a whole bunch of brand new innovation. And then a lot of the other technology that we're doing is about how to make that, you know, cost effective. So running in the cloud, elasticity, those sorts of things support that entire ecosystem.
I frankly think it's consumer-driven. I agree with these guys completely, right? Whether you're building a consumer application or whether you're building a business application targeted consumers, it's like the demands from the consumers are only increasing every day, and that is going to drive innovation. Whether you're talking about natural user interface where people want to have, you know, richer interfaces and sort of interesting new ways to be able to interact with the application, or whatever else it is, the demand is coming from the consumer, and that's what is going to drive the innovation. And then it's up to sort of, you know, the world to decide whether it's going to happen in this part of the world or that part of the world. I really don't have a prediction on that. But it's like consumer driven, that, you know, every business and every technology company and every company, frankly, on the face of the earth has to react to that. And I think that's what is going to drive a lot of innovation coming forward.
I do think it's interesting when you think about there being a link to developers and creative developers. And so I would say that the innovation will come from wherever the developers are the most creative and most entrepreneurial. And so maybe that, you know, creates an opportunity for you know, countries or regions that can treat the development model a little bit more differently, especially as we see these modern applications. Let's take another question. How do we get IT operations to buy into agile practices? It's just cowboy coding, right? Come on, you guys don't know what you're doing. All right, let's start with the two guys down at the end here.
Yeah. This is always an interesting one. I've been in situations where, and everybody probably else has, or dev teams or testers, everybody who works as agile as possible, 3 weeks, 4 weeks sprints delivering software, and then we are delivering the software to the IT operation guys, and they say, okay, we've got a maintenance window of 4 months. Not able to show our product, and we have to start a discussion. And I'm sure that question comes from this point of view.
I thought that's when you called the guys that have Azure, right?
Again.
That's when you call the Azure guys, right?
It takes
4 months to get it on your own hardware.
Actually, that's what we are using right now for one project. Because the IT guys had a service window of 4 months, let's say 4 months, I think it was 2 months. We are delivering very, very fast software, and we want to have feedback. We want to have the consumer feedback, the business feedback, and we are pushing it to Azure so we can show it to them. And that's why how we walked around the scenario that the IT guys aren't very agile at that moment.
How are they reacting to that?
They didn't know.
So there's your answer. Don't ask, don't tell.
So that's the side thing. But for sure, you want to have them connected together with the dev teams. And actually, 8 years ago, I was in a dev team, and the operational guys were with me in the same room. And we were delivering software very, very fast. And there was a problem with the installer packages, or you name it. It was a big SharePoint, BizTalk web application. And when there were some problems with authentication, or you name it, or some credentials, we can walk up to each other. Okay, this doesn't work. I've got some problems with our health and activity tracking in BizTalk. Okay, we have to do that. Then they removed the IT operation guy from our room, and everything started to break down. So just one good practice, sit together in a room, get them in your Scrum team, and start the discussion with them. Okay, when you've got major bugs in production, how do you get them on our Scrum backlog? Start that discussion and explain how you're working. At this moment, the IT service guy within Sogeti are starting to adopt Kanban as their major practice, and it's actually kind of good connected with Team Foundation Service. Now there is the Kanban board in there. We're not in the same project yet, but that's the slowly starting adoption process. And I also said it in the video, we've got a kind of continuous learning, continuous improvement process in place. This is definitely something we've got on our improvement backlog, which needs to be solved when we want to have continuous deployment in place. And one name which you hear lately a lot is the DevOps thing.
A lot of the good principles that you're talking about there are core principles in the DevOps movement.
Yeah, sure. And that's where we want to go. We're not there yet. Some projects are very agile in that way. Some operation guys are very agile in that way. But operation guys don't want to change. They want to have a stable environment. And you have to have the discussion. We are together. Build that trust together. That's for sure.
So I'm very fortunate at Columbia. We have an amazing infrastructure team and operations team. My peer, that as we refer to him, you know, he says he has lights and wires, and I have, you know, the development piece. I've taken some of my time and I've gone to some conferences with him to learn about the infrastructure. He's taken the time to go to development conferences and learn about how we develop, and that's made our teams work better. From an infrastructure perspective, we're about 95% virtualized, so that has really helped us be able to be more agile. I can get servers spun up in a matter of minutes or hours. We're able to scale very quickly. We keep a very close eye on application performance. We throw resources at it, on demand, if you will. So a lot of the things that Azure offers, we're able to do in-house.
So you're adopting the scale-out model, even though you are doing it internally.
Absolutely. And again, I can't emphasize enough, it's because of the partnership between infrastructure operations and development. And, we still have our moments. We still have the last-minute request that catches them off guard, but they're able to do it. They grumble about it, but because of what they've built, they're able to support what we're building. And it's really made us a better IS organization. So it's not, I've talked a lot about business value from a development perspective. Right. I like that, but that's not what we're preaching at Columbia. It's really more business value as an IS organization. So, don't just focus on development. Focus on the overall IS organization. Focus on operations. Focus on infrastructure. Focus on development. And what we have not done is, we haven't incorporated them into using the tools yet, I will say. The first hurdle was getting the BAs and the business bought in. I see bringing operations and infrastructure into our sprints. And we've done that in a few of our projects, but not had them use the tools. But that's somewhere where I see us going pretty
next.
Quickly. And I'm excited about that.
So a few things I heard there. Get dev involved in ops. Get ops involved in dev. Cross-train. Use things like Kanban to create demand that flows through the entire process. I heard virtualized environments, environments that tolerate self-provisioning, mm-hmm. So that devs can shoot themselves in the foot a little bit more easily.
Absolutely.
And those are the sorts of things that help move that agility downstream. Mm-hmm. Let's move on to the next question. How much wasted time do you believe a regular software factory loses trying to identify bugs rather than fixing them? Any feelings, guys?
So the way I think about it is, right now, hey, as you go through every phase in the product development lifecycle, all the way up to sort of design to development to testing to release to sort of, you know, deploying and operating and managing your application kind of thing. The cost of finding a bug increases exponentially, meaning, you know, 10x increase in cost for you to be able to find a bug at a later stage as opposed to an earlier stage kind of thing, right? So we talked, you know, Jason mentioned this earlier. Brian talked a lot about this, like, you know, hey, how do you think about quality earlier on so that you find the bugs to the extent there are bugs to be found early enough in the cycle as opposed to late in the cycle where the expenses go up considerably higher. That's something we sort of, you know, take to heart, and we've experienced that firsthand when we build products, and some of our products, I can tell you, have had our fair share of, like, you know, oh God, you know, what happened kind of thing. And so we know the expense, the cost, it not only costs us, but costs our customers, and that's sort of a huge cost. So the more you can think about, like, you know, hey, think about quality earlier on, find the bugs earlier on. In some sense, I would say, like, you know, we sort of debate internally at Microsoft, what is the definition of code complete? Mm-hmm. Is the definition of code complete the fact that the developer is done writing the code, or is the definition of code complete to say, hey, I've developed the code, and I've tested the code, and I've got a certain level of quality before I check it into the source tree, right? So that's how I think about, like, you know, the cost of finding bugs earlier versus later.
I'd say there is a mindset change that I think the person who submitted the question is also looking at. We've had situations at Microsoft where, again, because of the impact of hundreds of millions of deployments, we got into a mode where it's like, I can't test this stuff enough. It's got to be perfect. And in fact, we almost got ourselves to the point where we were scared to ship, because if I don't get it quite right, when you start doing that, it's a little bit like hitting Goldilocks here. It can be too hot, it can be too cold, right? If I push too far in the wrong direction, I kind of stall my innovation pipeline. Right, because I'm testing the heck out of everything, and I never quite ever ship. So it's a little bit of a mindset shift to shift back and say, okay, where do I have flexibility? Where can I actually change how I'm going to go do that, and maybe actually take more risk and be smart about it? So we implemented things like pairwise testing across platforms to make sure those would work correctly. A test in production is a good example, especially with services. You're just never going to be able to replicate 100% of what a deployed service running worldwide at geo replication. You can't just stick that into an emulator. It doesn't work, right? It's going to go out. Stuff's going to happen. So you better make sure that you've invested in being able to do the rapid kind of follow-on. So yes, I still do the testing, but it's not the point of having 100% bulletproof, you know, there. If I'm landing a rover on Mars, I may test that different. That's a different system. But if I'm going to scale out like this, you know, I have to have that kind of a system in there. And I think that goes to what the person's asking, which is there a point at which you can push that quality too far? You stagnate, you slow down. Maybe I should be looking for ways to get more throughput and then work on how fast can I turn around builds, right, so that if I do find defects, I can move more quickly. Now I can actually start tuning, you know, where that bar is.
Now when it comes to an individual defect, I've been in this industry for more than 20 years now, and my gut feel is it takes about 20% of the time to set up an environment to try to replicate it, about 30% of the time to actually find it, about 10% of the time to fix it, and then the other 40% to get it back into production. Would you guys agree or disagree with those kind of gut feel numbers?
Yeah, I agree with it. But it depends nowadays for when you are doing Team Foundation service, or are you creating that one, or when you're creating Team Foundation server, are you creating an App Store app? It depends. When you're creating a service, a SaaS solution, you can do it very quickly, bringing it to production. When you're going to build boxes or doing App Store apps, it takes a little bit longer time to put it back in production, for sure.
So things are changing as we get to more modern application deployment topologies.
Yeah, sure.
Especially on the client side.
Yeah.
Because even if it takes 5 minutes to fix the defect, you've still got a week before you can get it back into production. Okay.
It's the challenge nowadays. Yeah.
Let's take another question. How do you see Visual Studio playing an active role with natural interfaces? Natural interfaces. Anybody want to take that question? It's probably for one of you two.
You know, I continue to believe that natural user interfaces is an area where you're going to see a ton of innovation and changes as we move forward. You know, the most canonical example that we've all seen in the last many years is the rise of touch as a way for us to interact with the device, for us to interact with an application kind of thing. And so we work very, very, very closely with the platform teams and say, like, you know, hey, as and when we think about, you know, new ways for people to be able to interact with their device or with their application, what do we need to do inside Visual Studio, whether it's a set of tools or whether it's a set of libraries, or how do we hook into the platform in some deep ways for you to be able to easily provide that natural interface in your application so that you take advantage of the latest and greatest hardware advances that let your people or let your customers have the highest level of interactivity and richness of experience in the process, right? So touch is a good example. You can talk about voice recognition, you can talk about vision, you can talk about all these things. So we constantly pair up with the platform team figuring out, hey, what platform advances are we doing and what do we need to do in the tool set to make sure they go hand in hand to enable you to easily take advantage of that.
You've seen a couple of things, two categories I would call out. One, design, being able to go in and make it easier to design something up front so that the frameworks, the runtimes, et cetera, can help you out. You've seen this with the interactive mode and some of those sort of things there. And if we get into even more interactive skeletal tracking on Kinect, for example, how do I do designs where I don't, you know, I can build anything with a NAND gate? That doesn't mean I want to, right? So how do we let the design, you know, help you with that? The other one's diagnostics. So you saw some of the advanced stuff that we put in, inside of the debugger, the pixel debugging, those sort of things. If you're going to be starting to do just an unbelievable amount of compute to solve some of these problems, then you know, keeping all that in your head is going to be awfully hard. So we want to keep doing diagnostics tools that make that part easy. So easy to design, easy to implement, and then I can find the problems after I get going. So when I start doing some of these really advanced stuff, you know, how do we just make that heck of a lot more simple?
It already seems like, emulators and simulators become much more important because you can't develop on the device that you're deploying to in many of these situations. And I've already seen a big change in the way that teams work as they're moving toward multiple clients that they have to support, and that's kind of changed the processes that they use.
And integrating the test and playback and those sort of things. That's why when Orville showed, for example, let me put it into touch mode, now I can use a regular machine. Mm-hmm. That's an example of that. Getting that further off into automation and regression runs gives me the ability to pull the quality back up front. You know, so my test cases aren't just me standing in front of Kinect going like this all day long, which might be interesting, but you know, I need to have some repeatability and that sort of thing.
Nobody in Microsoft Research working on the Kinect version of Visual Studio?
We actually had a prototype of Scrum boards, actually, where someone had the Kinect and I could go up and grab a task and move it that way. So you could actually write that one pretty simply. I don't know about editing or typing code. That's still a little bit more keyboard intensive. So.
Right, right. Well, that's the next thing for voice, right? I just dictate as I code, right? I'm not sure I could work in that world.
You find the curly brace that you missed someplace.
Do we still need curly braces? But that's for the language geeks to decide. Let's take another question. Question for Brian. How does Columbia merge three different methodologies? I'm going to call it water, scrum, and fall, but water, agile, waterfall, agile, and scrum into a project. How does TFS and Visual Studio 2012 help?
So as a company, you know, we're still very much in that waterfall mentality. You know, we're in the middle of an ERP implementation with a very entrenched waterfall methodology for implementation. But our development teams, our BAs, we want to work in a more agile or scrum-like environment. So, you know, we've taken things like the traditional 50-page requirements document and broken it out and work on it in sprints. It's really not that difficult. You know, you're still doing the same work. Your delivery is still the same end result, but you're really just breaking your work into manageable chunks, putting it in your sprint. The big difference, though, is we still show something at the end of the sprint. So, you know, while we may take a 50-page requirement and break it into working on it in 2 weeks, we still go back and show the BA and the business what we've got after 2 weeks, and we get the feedback. So
the first time you started doing that, how did they react?
They kind of wondered what on earth we were doing. They're like, why are you showing this? It's not complete. You know, we don't understand. We're having trouble visualizing. But as we continued to do it, they became more open to it. And it's really, you know, I don't know that we'll ever get to pure Agile or pure Scrum, but what it has done is allowed us to make sure we're on the right track sooner, because you know, you get good requirements and you're kind of parroting back, so to speak, and the sooner you can do that, the better. But it still lines up with your waterfall project. It's you know, it's kind of hard to really describe. It's more of a go out and try it once and show them how it works and execute, and at the end you end up with a better product. You typically get faster. We're really finding after doing it more and more, we're better at estimating, we're better at quality, we're better at incorporating the feedback sooner. And the tools, the way the tools play into that is, I'll use estimating for an example. You know, we get an idea for a story or a task, and we put it in Team Foundation Server, and we t-shirt size it. And, you know, we have our ranges for t-shirt sizes, and then we get the requirement, and as we refine the requirement, we're continually updating the estimated to complete, you know, the effort left on it in the tool. And then at the end of the sprint, or at the end of the project, sometimes both, we go back and we look at, you know, what did it take to execute versus how did we estimate originally.
So you're tracking estimation variance.
Absolutely, and we're getting better. And, you know, I'm not to the point that
it's
I'm holding my team.
It's a great sign that the project is moving in the right direction when the estimation variance is going
down.
Yeah,
and I'm not to the point where I'm holding my team accountable for estimating well yet, but as we get better and better and better, you know, I start to question, you know, if I get an estimate that's 1,200 hours for something, I go back and I start to say, really? You know, have you really thought about it? And, you know, I'm going to look back at the end of the project and I'm going to see how close we were. And sometimes that refines the estimate immediately. Mm-hmm. And then going ahead and using the tool, continuing to get that status update. So that's been the really bigger part of it, is our BAs being able to look at a work item or a task or a story and find out where we are, because I require the developers to update status daily. So whether they finish their day at 5 o'clock or at midnight at home or 3 a.m., you know, we have a daily update into the tool so the BAs can find out what's going on. So if a developer works till 3 a.m. and then doesn't show up the next day till 2 in the afternoon, the BA still can get an update at 8 a.m. without, you know, running around trying to figure out, you know, where so-and-so, or picking up the phone and bothering them, or interrupting when they're writing code. Because, you know, any of you that write code, you know, sometimes you get in that zone and you start programming and somebody walks up and taps you on the shoulder to ask for an update, and, you know, you'll lose 3 or 4 hours of productivity because you've lost your train of thought there. So
shields up.
Absolutely, absolutely. So that's kind of how we've done it.
Now, do you use multiple process templates in TFS, or are all the projects using in the same process template?
We're still kind of using multiple. We're moving towards using a consistent template for all the different technologies, all the different projects, but we're not there yet. It's I'm still working on buy-in all across the board, but we're definitely getting there.
Let's go on to another question. Okay, balancing the ability to ship continuously with customers' ability to digest releases. This is a great one because, you know, maybe a user's not ready to update that mobile app or take that new feature or install that new version of Visual Studio. What's the balance? Clemens, it sounds like you want to jump in here.
I had a discussion yesterday with Brian Harry. Yeah. He announced on his blog, or he promised this kind of thing, that he is going to release every quarter new functionality. Okay, we are early adopters, so how should we handle that? So we should go in that pace the same way. And that we need to adjust. Our own IT environment should be adjusted to that quarterly release, and that's because we want to. But probably some customers of mine will say, okay, I'm not going to buy that quarterly release. I'm going to do every half year. I will skip one. Or I only adopt it when I'm shipping my software, and after that, I'm doing the update of TFS service, of TFS preview, TFS server. So that's I think how it goes. Constantly shipping every week new software to the customer won't help him.
I think it gets back to the organic architecture issue.
Organic,
you have to be able
to
have like a TikTok model where you can update a service on the back end and not have to require completely new clients to be spun, or vice versa.
Yeah.
Would you guys agree with that? I mean, you're dealing with this in real time, so.
Absolutely. Like, you know, the fact that, like, you know, hey, we are revving our services on a 3-week cadence, there is no way we are going to be asking our customers to say, oh, because we are revving the service, go pick up a new version of Visual Studio kind of thing, right? So the bar becomes higher in terms of you wanting to make sure that the services operate in their own cadence, but they continue working with the existing clients and be really thoughtful about, like, you know, when and where you ask people to sort of go to the next version or to the next update, because that's what is required to be able to light up what you're delivering in services.
in our case, I think you have to look at what are the reasons why I wouldn't want to go do that. And there's some very legitimate ones. One that we can actually help with is do a better job of actually getting updates. Like if you look at the NuGet package manager and those sort of things, I can actually update my project. It's a little bit more seamless than maybe what it was in the past. So there's techniques we can use to ease that, making deployment and setup and those things not be so impactful. But the other thing, sometimes I am working in an enterprise environment where I really do need to have a more predictable environment. I'm not actually ready to just pull down every new thing that comes out. And that's where we've gone in and balanced out with things like group policy and the updates. So if you've used the Power Tools, for example, you have seen us pop Toast on the bottom and says, hey, new version of Power Tools available. Now, those we tried to make super simple to get installed into the environment, not a big reboots and all the rest of that kind of stuff of the machine, and you can take advantage of the new work. That's probably a nice, simple sort of model. But you can also turn that off, so you kind of get the flexibility. So I think you have to have both of those. And until you get to the point where that's just so seamless you don't know and people have the quality and confidence level, you know, like those are the things that help mitigate it. Even there, I think you want to be careful.
I think it's actually an example of where the consumer space has done some real innovation around this, and we can learn a lot from how updates happen in that space. User controllable, notification when updates exist, but supporting previous versions and supporting previous capabilities for as long as reasonably possible. So
one interesting thing, every quarter we have a new release of Team Fornesia server. So every quarter we have an event like this.
Well, on that note, I'd like to thank everybody for being willing to stay and listen to the panel. I'd like a big round of applause for our panelists. That they've been great. And I think at this point, we are ready for lunch. Is that right?
Yeah, I think so.
Okay, thank you.
Thanks.
Thanks.
Thanks. Thanks.